Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, taking the long view of current events, Heather Cox Richardson is professor of history at Boston College, focusing on 19th century America. During Donald Trump's first impeachment, she started writing summaries of the day's events with an eye toward historical context. Her posts quickly found an audience that seemed hungry for a perspective that went beyond the headlines. Those nightly posts became the wildly popular online newsletter, Letters from an American. In it, Richardson writes about the news through the lens of history, the connection between power outages in Texas and Ronald Reagan's deregulation campaign, how this political moment feels like the 1850s or perhaps the 1890s. She joined me to talk about how she uses the past to help readers understand the present. Heather, talk about why you decided to start this newsletter. What motivated you?
Well, I didn't decide to start this newsletter. My readers decided to start this newsletter. And the answer to that was that I had a Facebook page with about 22,000 followers that I wrote on no more than once a week. That was my hard cutoff because I thought that people would get bored if they heard from me too much. And September of 2019, I hadn't written since the previous July because I was moving and it was summer and I was teaching a new course and there were all sorts of things that meant that I hadn't been as present as I should have been on that page. And I was preparing to commute, do my normal weekly commute from Maine back to Boston. And I was actually painting my house and I got stung by a yellow jacket and I'm allergic and I did not have my EpiPen. My poor brother-in-law who was with me probably is still in therapy for looking at me going, where's your EpiPen? And me going, oh dear, you don't want to know this. But because I didn't dare to get on the road until I saw how I would react to the sting, I sat down and started to type just to my readers on that Facebook page. And it was September 15th. And on Friday, the 13th of September, Adam Schiff, who was the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, had written a letter to Acting Director of National Intelligence, McGuire, saying that, you know, we know you've got a whistleblower complaint that you're sitting on, and it's against the law that you're sitting on this. You better hand that sucker over, and we suspect that it involves somebody high up, or you wouldn't be hiding it. And I recognized, because that's what I do for a living, that it was the first time that I saw anyway that a member of the legislative branch had made a specific accusation about a specific law against a member of the executive branch. And so I just sort of wrote about that. And then people started asking questions. And I thought, well, I really don't want to bore people by going on twice in 1 week. But you know, they really want to know. So I wrote 2 days later. And that's it. I've written every single night since. And it turns out there's a desperate hunger among people really to understand our political system. And, you know, it just happens that I'm trained to explain it. So I feel like I'm in a very fortunate place, but it does not come from me. It absolutely comes from my readers.
You mean in terms of the kinds of questions they're asking?
Yes, and the sense of community and the what really is special, I think, about the letters from an American are that they really represented a community. They represent a group of people who are tired of sort of very shallow divisiveness in our political discourse. And, you know, I basically when the pandemic happened, I started to do Facebook videos to try and, you know, just get people through. I had no agenda at all. And I always ask people what questions they have, and they are not questions like, you know, very simple questions. They're incredibly detailed. Can you please explain to us the history of the United States Postal Service and when, you know, when these laws happened? And I have to prepare for hours for each one of those casual chats because people really want to know answers.
And what you've done that's so different from what many others who are writing such newsletters is to put what you write into historical context.
Well, of course, I'm a historian, and that's how I see the world. So it's funny to me when people react to that as something unusual, because that is literally how I see the world. I grew up in a community where the history was very important, and I've always lived surrounded by history. So I can't look, for example, at an impeachment hearing and not see Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton and even arguments amongst the founders about what impeachment was designed to do. So, you know, it's very exciting to be able to invite people into my world.
Give me a sense of how you, from an historical context, saw the impeachment hearings of Donald Trump.
Do you mean both of them or the more recent one?
The more recent one.
Well, they're very interesting, of course. And one of the things that I try and emphasize is that I certainly look at things as a modern day American, and I certainly have my own political preferences in this modern moment. But I also look at things as a historian and as somebody who cares very profoundly about American democracy. So it was interesting to me about the recent Senate trial, which I'll be happy to talk about the House impeachment as well, but the Senate trial, I suspect, is where people's focus on, is that the things of which the former president were accused were heinous. We have never in our history had a leader of the executive branch trying to destroy the legislative branch. It broke our long tradition of a peaceful transfer of power, and it came perilously close to being a democratic coup. And that stops me dead right there every single time. So what was on the table was huge to begin with. And then what the House managers did, I thought so very well, was to put together a really quite damning case. But what was interesting to me about that moment were two things. First of all, the fact that the House managers did put together such an articulate, well-supported case, which I thought spoke very highly of them. But then the other thing that was interesting to me was that it didn't matter, that the Republican senators are at a moment in their history right now where it simply did not matter what the facts on the ground said. They were going to acquit their leader no matter what. And that, again, you know, you might, in a modern perspective, that's upsetting in any number of ways, but as a problem for our democracy, the idea that you could have members of the Senate, which once upon a time was known as the world's greatest deliberative body, I think that that's historical now rather than present day, but that they could look at the facts on the ground and simply say, we don't care. And people said, oh, well, you know, this is the most bipartisan vote for a conviction in our history. Well, yes, except for the fact that the whole reason that Richard Nixon stepped down in 1974 was that members of his own party, led by Barry Goldwater, went to the White House and said, we will vote to convict you, so you need to resign. And it just shows, I think, how far we have come since 1974, when the current day Republican Party, which you may or may not know, I have maintained for a long time, was not the traditional Republican Party, that they are a cabal that is very anti-democratic, that they have simply left their roots that far behind. And this is an ongoing problem for our democracy. It did not end with the inauguration of Joseph Biden.
So when January 6th happened, what were your reactions and what were the reactions of your readers?
My reaction was very emotional and very profound. For me, the sight of the Confederate flag flying in the U.S. Capitol was a gut punch like nothing else that I have lived through in my political years compares to. Because, and again, one of the things about being a historian is, yes, we study history, but when you really get into your sources, in many ways, you feel as if you are living it. Of course, you're not, but it's like being immersed in a really compelling movie or something. And so I saw that Confederate flag around the Capitol, and all I could think of was Julia Ward Howe, who was a reformer from Boston during the Civil War, who was herself going through a hellish life at the time. She was married to an abusive partner and she had small children, and they had toured Washington, D.C. in the early years of the war. And if you remember, the whole fallout from the first Battle of Bull Run was the fact that neither side was really prepared, but the Union soldiers tossed aside their haversacks and ran, and they were so close, the fighting was so close to the city of Washington that the military advisors really believed that the Confederates were going to overrun Washington. So they take the soldiers that they've got and they line them up in circles around the Capitol building and around the White House. And Julia Ward Howe has been out touring the battlefields that day and looking at the camps. And she goes home that night and puts her kids to bed there. And she and her husband and the small children are in a hotel room. And she wakes up in the middle of the night and this poem has come to her. And she writes the Battle Hymn of the Republic. You know, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. And then the next verse starts, I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. And that altar and those circles had been overrun, and they had been overrun from inside our government. And I'm not entirely sure, no matter how this plays out, that I will ever get over seeing that Confederate flag flying in our Capitol.
It was shocking. I do agree. And as you and I are speaking this morning, Amy Klobuchar is holding hearings on Capitol Hill with the individuals who had responsibility to protect the Capitol. And we shall see how that goes. Yesterday, our new president, Joe Biden, honored the 500,000 plus individuals who've died of COVID. And I wonder, looking back, since you began writing in 2019, I wonder whether you believe this horrific epidemic here in the United States, which has taken more lives than anywhere else, could have been avoided or ameliorated.
I mean, again, it's a political question. It was always very interesting to me because the obvious thing for then President Donald Trump to have done was to address the pandemic even in a halfway efficient manner, to simply try and listen to the science, because he would have been reelected. If he had gone ahead and managed to keep the pandemic under wraps, that would have been a huge feather in his cap. And yet he, every single moment, chose the short-term answer that would push the problem down the road. And one of the things that I find most interesting about the pandemic, and one of the things I always try and emphasize, is it is horrific. Our numbers are horrific. And what do they say? You know, one death is a tragedy and 100,000 deaths are a statistic. But every one of those deaths is a person who was part of our community, even if we didn't know those people individually. And many of whom, of course, all of us did. But so that's always out there. But it's interesting to me that it reminds me our response both to the coronavirus and now to the disaster in Texas and so many of the other things that happened on that four-year watch really have disproven the whole, if you will, Reagan experiment in getting rid of government, getting rid of modern developed government, because we clearly need to be able to work together. I heard a wonderful joke, really, but it resonated when somebody was talking about the Affordable Care Act and said, you know what, let's get rid of healthcare altogether and let's go ahead and start a GoFundMe. And we can all put our money into the GoFundMe and then you only take the money out if you need it and we'd have plenty. And someone said, and that's called health insurance. But at the turn of the last century, there was a huge disaster also in Texas when there was a terrible hurricane that hit Galveston. And when it did, it was a true disaster. Of course, they did have some modern forecasting, but they didn't know how bad it was going to be. And the Galveston hurricane just wiped out Galveston. And there were horrific stories associated with it. There was a train that was going into the hurricane. And of course, it disappears. And, you know, people are in hotels as the city floods, watching bodies float by. It's really, truly a disaster. And the very corrupt machine political organization that was in charge of Galveston couldn't handle the disaster. And then lots of money and lots of private help poured in to help the victims of the disaster. And they didn't know how to manage that either. And from that, we get the idea of modern urban management. And that spreads from Galveston across the country in that period where people say, look, it turns out it's not a good thing to turn over our government to a bunch of cronies who basically line each other's pockets and all get rich off them. So I've watched what's happened in Texas recently and, of course, what's happened with our pandemic and thought, I wonder if this was the tipping point that history books will look at and say, oh, look, this is the moment where Americans rejected the idea of deregulation, getting rid of the government, and instead embraced the idea that we must take on projects that are bigger than us altogether so that we can answer them. And interestingly enough, that was precisely Abraham Lincoln's definition of why we needed to have government do certain things. He said the government should do the things we can't do for ourselves, which seems to me to be a recurring theme in American history.
And of course, it's fascinating that the governor of Texas is currently blaming green energy on what's happened in Texas.
Well, isn't that interesting, though? Because, I mean, one of the things that has fascinated me about the rise of the current day Republican Party, beginning actually before Reagan, the people who start to articulate the rhetorical strategy of this current day Republican Party are people like William F. Buckley Jr. all the way back in 1951 with his God and Man at Yale. And then 3 years later, the book he wrote with L. Brent Bazell called McCarthy and His Enemies, which says that anybody who wants to have a regulated economy or a basic social safety net or promotion of infrastructure is a capital L liberal, made capital to look somewhat like a capital C communist from the Communist Party in China. And they recognize that Americans actually like business regulation. They like a social safety net. They like roads that you can drive on and clean air and clean water and safe food. So they developed a rhetorical strategy that increasingly relied on image, on mythology, on the idea that a government that did those things was somehow crushing liberty and individualism. And what's interesting about this moment, I think, is that you've gotten to the point in that now Trump wing of the Republican Party, but also to some degree the business wing, that relies no longer on facts at all, but rather on a fantasy. And what's interesting to me about that is, at what point, even if you've been along with a fantasy, and we all, you know, probably have aspects of our lives where we're clinging to some unreality. I'm thinking of having been a Boston sports fan for many years where you always kept hoping. But, you know, to some degree, we all do that. But at what point do you have to say, oh, come on, like I followed you all this way, but I just can't blame what happened in Texas on the Green New Deal that has not been enacted and not mention at all the fact that the Republican governors for the last, I don't know how many years, have slashed all regulation and made sure that Texas stays on its own grid, when in fact El Paso, which had to join the Western grid a number of years back, was fine, you know, because they actually had winterized. So, you know, you just wonder how long this grift, if you will, can keep going. And I have to think that it's reaching the end of its game.
But Heather, I understand, because Texas is so much in the news these days, but we're talking about 74 million voters who followed Trump. What in our history can explain that kind of pursuit of a person who has done so many things that seem outrageously out of step with the majority of the country?
Well, we've never had a cult following for a person in this way, and that's different and worth exploring. And Trump, I think, is a fascinating character because he is a salesman more than he's a politician, and he reflects back to people what they want to see. I mean, that's sort of the hallmark of somebody like him. But the moment we're in looks very much like the 1850s or the 1890s. And those moments are ones in which, first of all, the media is limited. So if you, for example, were a white person, probably illiterate, in the American South in the 1850s, all you knew about Northerners who were talking about a different kind of economy than a slave-based economy was that they were trying to kill you. You know, and anybody who tried to say, well, that's not really right, got ridden out of town on rails, was not permitted to vote. And on occasion, when in the 1850s, there's actually a book written by a white North Carolinian, virulently racist. But he says to other white, poor North Carolinians and members of the South, we have a problem. And the problem is not the Northerners. The problem is the elites in the South who are monopolizing all the land, making the laws so that they keep us down, keeping us from education. We really need to go ahead and take back our government. And when he wrote that book, his name was Hinton Rowan Helper, and the book was called The Impending Crisis and How to Solve It. That book was banned from the entire South. So first of all, you're in a moment where the media gets bubbled. You end up in your own bubble, and that's one thing. But then once you go down that road, it's very easy for politicians to take control of their legislation, of their legislative bodies. And you see this, of course, in places now like Georgia, like Wisconsin, where it doesn't really matter how many votes Democrats get because the system has been so rigged in favor of the Republicans. And then it's only a question of time until they take over the federal government, which I think is where we are right now. And that's what happened in the 1850s. Now, that being said, one of the things that I like to point to here is the fact that in the post-Reconstruction South, people held elections all the time. It had just become a one-party region. And so we've done this before. My concern is, of course, the fact that the one-party South was a white South that lynched Black and brown people. But for even white Americans who might be racist on their own and might think that that's just a fine idea, look at what happened to that region. The whole point of democracy is you need to have at least two viable parties so that there is oversight of whoever is in charge. And without having oversight of the American South in the 1880s and the 1890s and then on up into the 1960s, the region didn't manage to develop. It did end up being incredibly repressive. The economy stagnated. You know, it's not a viable way to run a democracy. And I look at the moment we're in and I feel like I worry terribly that what we are doing is we're trying to create the people who are now supporting the Republicans, certainly the Trump Republicans, are trying to recreate the Reconstruction South over the entire country. And you know, the steps that they have taken are not dissimilar from the ones that the Solid South took after 1876.
So considering all that, do you see any avenue through which we might be able, or Republicans and Democrats might be able, to get back on track to a true two-party system?
Well, you know, I'm a glass half full kind of person, and I believe yes, and here's why. So first of all, when we talk about Republicans and Democrats, it's worth remembering that the Republican Party, only about 25% of registered voters currently are in the Republican Party. And those are numbers that I pulled just the other day. They were from before January 6th. And we know that the Republican Party has lost at least 140,000 members since then, and possibly more. We don't know. The largest group of people identified right now in America is independents. And one of the things that political scientists will tell you is that most Americans agree about most stuff. I mean, and you can see this, I can talk about Biden in a minute, but most people basically agree on common sense gun regulation, on the idea of abortion being safe, legal, and rare, on taxes and who should bear them, on investment in the economy, on in education. We tend to agree on pretty much everything. Now, we wiggle around the edges, but there's a solid body of Americans who believe the same things and want the same kind of relationship between individuals in our society and between the federal government. But the minute that politicians begin to politicize an issue, all of a sudden we all take our toys and go to our corners. And one of the tricks is going to be to stop that politicization. And one of the reasons that I have found Joe Biden really surprising, to be honest, and also refreshing, is that he has absolutely refused to play the I'm going to go sit in my corner game. And one of the other things that has been really interesting watching him in his first month in office is that While most presidents have used executive measures, executive orders and memos and things like that, in very divisive ways, using them to push through things that are unpopular, he has done the opposite. He has gone after low-hanging fruit that Americans actually want. And you can see this is causing great consternation among people in the Senate because they have been able to be a break on popular legislation now for more than a decade. They've been able to stop everything dead, and he has simply gone around them, which is, as a systemic issue, I'm not really in favor of more power flowing toward the executive branch. But it's a really interesting maneuver because what it does is it simply says to the Senate, okay, you're not going to put into law some of the many very popular things that Americans want, because a very small percentage of the American population is against that. And so we have senators, for example, a minority of senators who represent as little as 38% of the American people can stop legislation that is enormously popular. He's just said, okay, I'm going to work around that to the degree I can. And you can see in his popularity numbers that it's working. So if you're somebody who aspires to hold an elective office, what are you going to do? Are you going to try and reinforce that polarization and hope you can pick up voters by simply standing against something? Or are you going to say, hey, look, there's a middle there, and a very popular middle that I can jump in on? And when you're watching the Republican Party right now, I think you can see them trying to figure out which way is the best way to jump.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Heather Cox Richardson.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Heather Cox Richardson. She is a history professor at Boston College and author of the newsletter, Letters from an American. What about President Biden's $1.9 trillion bill that many Republican senators, including a couple of Democratic senators, are saying they will vote against? President Biden is talking about reconciliation, and that's kind of the opposite of what you're talking about, isn't it? I mean, going around those Republican senators who won't vote for that $1.9 trillion package.
Again, one of the things that's interesting about that package is how popular it is in the country at large. It's very popular. And so when you talk about reconciliation, I always get a little unhappy about all these different terms because they make it all sound so incredibly confusing.
Yeah.
Because reconciliation, there's a limit of three on them, and it's got to have this in it, and it's got to have that on it. And,
right.
You know, the Senate is one of those places where the rules have just rolled for so long. That it's hard to untangle them all. And anytime anybody asks me about a Senate rule, I'm like, hang on, let me go look it up. But that's a really great example because it's a very popular measure. And there are many reasons that I could outline why it's popular, not only politically, but also culturally. There is increasingly a sense that the government has been working for the very wealthy and not for people on the ground, who are obviously the ones who got us through this pandemic. And that's, I think culturally, that's really coming to the fore right now. In a way, for example, that similar things came to the fore in the 1890s when legislation really seemed to be packed in favor of the trusts and against workers. Again, really, a really key, you know, a moment that looks very much like today. But what's interesting about this coronavirus package and the talk about reconciliation and all that, what you're really talking about is whether or not this enormously popular package is going to pass Congress, because that's where it has to go through. And what's stopping it is the Senate. And it is, again, worth remembering that this Republicans have 50 seats in the Senate and the Democrats have 50 seats in the Senate, but they represent vastly different numbers of Americans. So the Republican senators represent, and I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, but literally tens of millions fewer people than the Democrats do. So first of all, there's a problem there that the Republican senators, if in fact you insist on the filibuster, which is again a really bastardized version of something that that grew up in the 19th century, whether or not you're going to permit this grafting onto the Senate to go ahead and stop a popular measure. And one of the things that's interesting to me about this coronavirus measure coming up is that it, in a way, sort of seems to put the nail in the coffin of the filibuster, which was developed in the 19th century really to stop civil rights legislation. But it did at the time at least involve some poor guy having to stand up there and talk for days. That got changed so that now a senator can simply threaten to filibuster something, and instantly it makes the need for a simple majority in the Senate turn into a need for a supermajority for 60 votes. This was never how the Senate was intended to be operated. And what that means then is that a small minority of the American population can stop enormously popular things. And that, by the way, is precisely what happened in the 1850s when Southern Democrats in the Senate could stop very popular measures. And there comes a point when democracy itself simply can't function that way. Either we have to say, okay, we quit. We don't really care about the idea of democracy. And we're going to go ahead and turn everything over to a very small group of senators and possibly members of the executive branch, depending on who's in charge of it, and they can run things for the rest of us. Or there comes a point when Americans say, look, we got to go ahead and get rid of the systems that no longer are serving our democracy. And it turns out the filibuster is one. Increasingly, again, because of changes made to it since the founders set it up, the Electoral College is another. And I think those things are going to have to be on the table going forward. And it shocks me to say that, because if you and I had this conversation 20 years ago, I would have said, oh, no. I care about tradition. We can't do this. But even somebody like me at this point says our system at this point is loaded against democracy. We cannot continue to let it be that way without giving up democracy. And I think a lot of us actually kind of like the idea of having a say in our government.
I'd like to ask you about Judge Merrick Garland, whose confirmation hearings were held yesterday. I must say he was so moving and so articulate, so forthcoming in everything he said. But in his testimony, he spoke about the so-called big lie which fueled the January 6th attack. Remind us of the historical context of the big lie.
What Judge Garland was talking about was what is now being called the big lie in America, and that is the lie that Joe Biden did not win the 2020 election. He did, by a lot, by more than 7 million votes and by 232 electoral votes for Donald Trump to 306 for Joe Biden. This is a big win in either count. And it's a big win, especially because it's against an incumbent, which is very hard to do. The last time an outside challenger to an incumbent did that well was Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932. So it's a big deal. And the Trump wing of the Republican Party has insisted that this is a lie. And they challenged it in court and lost 63 or 64 times. The cases were dismissed for lack of evidence. They didn't necessarily lose. And they are insisting that there were irregularities in the count. Now, again, each state where they contested it, the recounts were done with observers and they came out the same way. And now they are trying to argue that because of the way that the states extended voting hours because of the pandemic, that was a violation of state constitutions, and therefore the Supreme Court should step in and invalidate those elections. And in that case, the Supreme Court has said it's not going to do that. It's not going to review those things. So they've lost on that front as well. And yet the Trump Republicans are refusing to acknowledge that Joe Biden is the elected president. And this is mind-boggling. Steve Scalise, who is the second Republican in the House of Representatives, has this weekend refused to say that Biden had won. He actually went on to push the big lie. Increasingly, Republicans are refusing to admit that Joe Biden won this election. And that is completely unprecedented. So we've had four occasions in America where, in fact, the person who has been elected by the popular vote has lost in the Electoral College. And in only one of those cases was there a contest, a long-time contest. And when it was over, the person who lost, despite winning the popular vote, accepted the results, did not try and undercut his opponent. And in this case, the fact that they are keeping this lie alive is a suggestion that they are trying to keep alive the Trump voters who are powered by the idea, and this is very important, that they are the ones protecting American democracy. You know, the thing that is motivating people like Jessica Watkins, who has been arrested for her participation in the Capitol riot, was not that she was trying to overturn the government, but rather that she was trying to protect the government. And that's a really key issue here, that so many people are motivated by their belief that they and Donald Trump are the ones protecting democracy, not attacking it. Now, the history of the big lie goes back, of course, to Germany and Hitler and the idea that you continue to motivate political opposition by claiming that you have been stabbed in the back. It's called the stab in the back myth, too. And the idea is the country would be great, our polity would be great, except for those people. And the problem with that, first of all, is it pollutes our politics. But second of all, think about that. This is the exact same language that white supremacists used in the 1890s and the 1910s and the 1910s to justify purging their society from the black people that they believed were polluting the polity and were polluting society. And, you know, the language is really clear where that goes. And this is something that keeps people like me up at night.
It, in your mind, must be so dangerous to hear these lies perpetuated. What could the outcome be if these lies continue to be thrown out there, not only by Trump himself, but by his followers?
They are hideously dangerous, for sure, yes. And where they could go is to every bad place that you and your listeners are imagining. They certainly have gone there in the past, and they are going there now. I mean, one of the things that I would like people to remember is some people say to me, well, you know, we're never going to actually have another civil war. We're not going to lose lives over this. And I'm like, look around you. We are losing lives now to this. We lost lives in the Capitol riot. We are losing our black neighbors to vigilantes. There are currently attacks going on against brown people in America, against Asians in California. This low-level simmering violence could get bigger and bigger. There's also a lot of violence against women we are not talking about that I think really should be highlighted front and center, because part of this domination theory, if you will, the idea that this small group needs to take back the country, is directed against women as well. So there is that enormous danger. And the one thing that to sort of work around it, I don't think we have to go down this path. And I think we are increasingly aware that it's dangerous and Americans are pulling back from it. But one of the things that I would urge people to think about is less, oh, this is so horrible what X is doing. But one of the things that an elderly friend of mine always used to say when I got excited about ideas and that so-and-so was such politician was doing this because he believed this. And, you know, from the Civil War years, she would always say to me, Heather, follow the money. Who's getting money and who's losing money? And one of the things when we think about all these exchanges is certainly people want power, but the currency of power in America is money. And it's really worth thinking about who's making money from telling you that your neighbor is, you know, trying to destroy democracy. You know, when Merrick Garland says that at his hearing, I don't think Merrick Garland is making money from that. He's actually leaving a permanent position to try and defend our democracy. When a personality from the Fox News channel says it, I'm maybe less convinced it's a principled position. And that might be one way to sort of think about where we are and where we want our money as a country to go. Because that's the other piece here, of course, is that our wealth and our income has dramatically moved upwards since 1981, which is part of what is fueling this fear and anger on the part of so many Americans that they have lost their ability to rise.
Money is very much involved with questions regarding Donald Trump. The Supreme Court has decided his taxes. can be turned over to the New York prosecutor, Cyrus Vance, and to others who are very interested in looking at them. Will you be writing about Donald Trump's taxes?
Well, you know, it's so funny you're going down this road because, you know, I'm a historian. We love documents. Like, if I could do anything in this moment, honestly, one of the things that frustrated me most about as a person about President Trump was that if you could sit in that White House and you could read any document that the American intelligence agencies have collected over the years, like who really bombed Wall Street in 1920? You know, where is Jimmy Hoffa buried? You know, or what is our newest information about any random country? Like, I would never have slept. I would just have read and read and read and read and read. Now, we know there are millions of documents coming from the Trump finances. And of course, no one person is ever going to do that. But aside from anything else, one of the fun things about documents, and fun is used in a very professional sense here, is that there are many things that people are unhappy with about the former president. And they want to say, oh, he broke this piece of the Constitution. Absolutely true, perhaps. But we don't necessarily have a specific law that covers. One of the reasons that prosecutors got someone like the criminal mastermind Al Capone on tax evasion charges was because documents, the numbers are written down. And so it's not going to be easy. I mean, one of the things that one does when one is trying to hide something is throws a ton of documents at you in the hopes that you're not going to ever be able to work your way through them. But there will be people working their ways through them. And I can't tell you how professionally it will be exciting to me to have someone show me, here's a document that has this number, and here's a document that has a different number. They don't match up. That's a crime. Because that's for historians, that's what we look for. We look for the smoking gun in the documents because documents are much harder to lie. It's much harder for a document to lie than it is for a human being to lie. So I will certainly be writing about it, but I always caution people. I don't think this is all happening tomorrow. It's going to take a long time to go through all these things. And that's what historians are good at. People say everyone's going to forget. And I always say, I'm not. I'm not going to forget because I'm going to be paying attention to this until I can't pay attention to anything else any longer. And I don't just mean Trump. I mean this crucial moment in our American democracy, which is so frightening in so many ways, but in so many other ways is so exciting. Think of the world we might be able to live in 10 or 20 years.
But on that note, and finally, do you think history gives us hope for the future or gives us pause?
The beauty of history is it's the story of human beings, and none of us is all one thing or all another. I think history gives us enormous hope because we have endured horrific things throughout human history, but certainly throughout American history. We have great heroes who have, in my mind always goes to Fannie Lou Hamer, who, you know, basically, in her fight to enable Black people to vote, and I'm being artistic here, but basically, white supremacists killed her, but they didn't. You know, they tried, and she got up from the vicious beatings and the job loss and everything, and said, you know what, you killed me once, you're not going to kill me again. And she got up and she helped change America. So this moment is frightening. There's no doubt about it. We would all love to live in a moment where the world is perfect. But here's a newsflash. None of us ever have. We all get our crisis to deal with. This is not perhaps the crisis any of us wanted, but it's the one we got. And people in the past have endured. I hope people in the future will endure. I will say that we must, of course, deal with the existential crisis of climate change. But we have the opportunity to do that if we act quickly. And so, you know, in a nutshell, yeah, I have hope. I wouldn't get up every day and go to work and come home at night and at 10 o'clock at night start writing for, you know, 4 to 6 hours if I didn't believe it was serving a purpose. I promise you.
Heather, thank you.
It's been such a pleasure.
That was Heather Cox Richardson. She's history professor at Boston College and the author of the daily newsletter, Letters from an American. Her Her most recent book is How the South Won the Civil War, Oligarchy, Democracy, and the Continuing Fight for the Soul of America. And that's all for today. Thanks to those who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverka of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer is Steve Lack. Thanks for listening, all. Please stay well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.